The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're in the Delaware Valley. Welcome to the Files Law Hour here on WWDB Talk 860. Awesome show. Lots going on. Caitlin, how are you?
Good morning, Joe. How are you?
Well, I'm fantastic. As you well know, I love taking that trip up to Levittown to the office.
It's been a while.
It has.
You've been catered me coming out here the last 3 months.
We have a great guest, Joe Oxman, who's a fantastic attorney in the region of Oxman, Goodstadt, and Kurtz. How are you, Joe?
Good. Good to be here, Joe.
It's great to have you. Now, just so you understand, is it sunny out right now?
It appears to be.
Okay. So that's a little bit of an inside. Now, so what's that say? That means you got to come down here all the time.
Because
we have something going on. We do shows on location, and then we'll record them and send them to the station, and they'll produce them on occasion. Every time I go to Caitlin's office in Bucks County, I bring the rain with me.
Every single time.
And I mean, it just doesn't.
Every single time.
There are torrential downfalls.
It's not even like a light rain. It's like, please take shelter.
Right. Exactly. So we can pretty much bank on that. But
it was gross this morning. It was kind of rainy.
It was.
But yeah, I was on a run and I was like, it's gross out here, but it is sunny now.
Where were you running?
Just around my neighborhood.
I don't know how I miss you. For crying out loud. Mother of God.
I don't know. We're always out on runs for the same time.
Yeah, I know. And at the gym. but I will tell you something pretty cool. One of my favorite guests also from Caitlin's show, besides you now, Joe, the world champ, Tim Witherspoon. And he called in. And he called in last show.
He did. He was on live last show with us.
He was. So,
champ.
You know, we're keeping a high level.
We get the heavyweight champs on the show.
That's right. But lots of great stuff to talk about. What I'd like to do, obviously, Caitlin, remind our listeners, obviously, about yourself and the firm. If they've been hiding under a rock on a desert island for the last 2 years.
I hope it's not the first time tuning in.
I know.
I run my own workers' compensation law firm out in Bucks County. We serve all of Pennsylvania, representing injured workers against the insurance carriers. And we actually have our big conference today, big Pennsylvania Worker Comp Conference. So I'll be driving to Hershey right after the show ends.
That's right. And I will say this. I called Caitlin and I said, the day of the show with Joe, you know, we have the Workers' Comp Conference in Hershey. And she said, I'm going to the show and then I'm driving to Hershey. So she's...
Long drive.
Yeah.
I'm not looking forward
to it. How far is Hershey?
From here, it's about an hour 45.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, not. I went to the Labor and Energy Conference, okay, last year. You want to talk about a long drive? Erie, PA.
Mm. Oh, no.
Woo! Holy cow.
Been there many times. Both my kids played travel ice hockey, and we had tournaments in Erie in February.
Oh my gosh.
Freezing cold.
You're right off the river.
I've never been to Erie. I've never been there.
We're on air, so we can't really comment.
I've never been there. I hear it's beautiful in the summertime. Mm-hmm. I know they have a lot of sailing culture there, you know, because of the lake. The only time I've ever been there is in the dead of winter.
And what's interesting is, so we were at the convention center. And man, it is beautiful there.
It's like, very nice.
I heard it's beautiful up there. Yeah.
You're right on the lake, the whole deal.
They have a really good minor league hockey team there, the Erie Otters.
Okay, yeah. I think the Flyers, wasn't the Erie at one point in time? I'm not sure if
they were. I don't think they ever were. I know they're the only American team in their league. It's a minor league team. All the other teams in their league are from Canada.
Yeah.
And they're the only team that's American.
Well, Erie kind of intersects a lot of... it's a big hockey region there, right?
Oh, huge, you know? Yeah. Yeah, Mercyhurst College is there. They're Division I hockey.
So, you know, I mean, it was a great weekend when we were about, you know, I'll take Hershey in regards to the ride. Because, man.
Yeah.
Another hockey town with the Hershey Bears.
Yeah. So, you know, lots to talk about. Joe, if you would, a little bit about yourself and the firm.
Sure. My name's Joe Oxman. I'm with the firm of Oxman, Goodstadt, and Kurtz. We're a personal injury firm. I specialize in civil rights law. My practice is focusing on suing police officers, correctional officers for misconduct, excessive force, assault, battery. Also do prison medical malpractice work. I've sued county jails, state jails, federal correctional facilities for acts of misconduct as well in terms of their correctional officers and for prison medical malpractice.
So then this is a timely conversation. Anybody see what happened with Tyreek Hill over the weekend?
Yes.
Okay. And I just got the video sent to me. Okay. And
I haven't seen the video.
I'll send it to you. Holy cow. Okay.
And this happens all the time.
Right. Which is, in a sense, there's a lot there, okay, especially in the prison system, okay. But also, like you talk about personal injury, there's an area of the law that recently, I mean, we've done a number of shows on civil sexual assault, you know, with a number of the attorneys. Now, you know, I'll say this: this is not an anti-police show or anything like that. Most of officers and our law enforcement are fantastic. They do a great job in the midst of some very difficult circumstances. However, sometimes the conditions themselves, okay, and I've done make it very difficult. Somebody goes in, they don't have PTSD. 6 months, or, you know, 5, 10 years later, they've been in a difficult situation. And all of a sudden, they're not the same person that they were, or they're under circumstances that make it very risky for them to be in that. And I'm sure it happens all day long. And then, you know, you have your people who are just cowboys. Having said that, there's an area of the law that, in a sense, interests me a lot. Okay. And this is the area where district attorneys, okay, I believe that a district attorney, okay, when you have a civil assault, a criminal assault situation, any type of situation where the property owner of a, say it's a big, you know, big parking lot or you know, and, you know, somebody gets assaulted, it's not lighted properly. There's a lot of different, it could be, you know, a lot of these things that are going on with these schools and stuff like that, where they have the, you know, the teachers that are predators and stuff. I'm talking about like Glenn Mills and all those things that have happened. My point is,
I actually have two Glenn Mills cases.
So I think this. I think the DA, who is seeking justice, you know, to put the criminal behind bars, should also be obligated to refer that sexual assault victim to a personal injury firm. Why? I'll tell you why. Maximum justice. You're going to tell me, so this person now has got beat the hell up, okay? They may not work again. I get it. It's nice to say our way of giving justice is just to prosecute the criminal, but that person may never work again.
Well, it is. So, I understand what you're saying.
But Joe, well, give me one more second. I believe, let's just say that the owner of that building, there was 5 or 6 sexual assaults. To me, the owner of that building is as much responsible for this crime as he, you know, there he is, or you know, she, whatever. But, you know, he is an accomplice. Okay, so my point is, why isn't there maximum justice where there can be a civil recovery for somebody who may never work again, either because of emotional issues, as well as a criminal prosecution. Any thoughts there?
Well, I mean, first off, to require a district attorney's office to somehow refer a case to a personal injury.
I wouldn't require it.
Well, there would be a conflict of interest situation, and you can't have a district attorney just go through a Rolodex and refer cases to private attorneys. I will say this, though. Often, in the civil rights cases that I handle, often I wonder why cases, if there has been sort of a criminal prosecution, unfortunately, they rarely happen against police officers, but if there is some sort of criminal prosecution, the question is whether or not those cases are referred to the Federal Department of Justice, for further criminal prosecution or for some sort of civil liability. unfortunately, the Department of Justice has been politicized over many years from sort of presidential administration to administration because, again, it's an executive branch agency. And for years, the power of the Department of Justice has hemmed and hawed depending on what administration is in power. During the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, you had for 8 years very little Department of Justice investigations into police misconduct or jail or correctional facility misconduct. Under the Obama administration, of course, it increased it. During the Trump administration, it plummeted. So
I get the pattern.
the problem with civil suits under the 1983 Civil Rights Act is that they have to be initiated by private attorneys. And there's very few people like me that do these cases because they're a lot of work. They're heavy on the pleadings. These cases rarely, if ever, settle. So you have to be willing to go all the way to trial on them. Generally speaking, the defense attorneys that represent police officers, correctional officers, they usually have some sort of political justification for what they do. So they often do not look at these cases sort of from a set of eyes that
is impartial.
That's impartial, not necessarily impartial, but realistic when they know the liability is really bad. I just want to get to one point you were saying about police officers. When I started doing this type of work back in 2006, I came to the conclusion that less than 10 or 15% of police officers were creating the kind of havoc in terms of excessive force, police misconduct, corruption, et cetera. And I got to tell you, it's increased incredibly. I believe, and I'm a member of the National Police Accountability Project, as well as the Philadelphia Law Enforcement Accountability Project, that at least 25 to 30% of police officers on a daily basis, like what happened to Tariq Hill, are violating people's constitutional rights. Usually in those sorts of situations, we're talking about simple traffic stops. I have taken the depositions of hundreds and hundreds of police officers over the last 20 years. And I got to tell you, at least half of police officers, when I take their depositions, cannot even give you a definition of what probable cause is. I think there are two major problems in law enforcement. One, starting with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, a number of police officers have been recruited after they've come back from those wars to be police officers. Many of these police officers have been suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and were multi-tour combat officers. These are the officers who present a profile that are more likely to commit acts of excessive force. I have two officer-involved shooting cases here, one in Philadelphia involving the tragic death of 18-year-old Anthony Allegrini, who was shot and killed by a state trooper, Robert Sobeck. And then I also have a case where Timothy Michael Randall in Rusk County, Texas, was shot and killed by a four-tour combat police officer, Shane Iverson, who has admitted on several law enforcement podcasts that he's done, he's been guest on, in which he continues to suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. These are the type of police officers who should never be, well, first off, they should never be allowed to be police officers if you've been suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, because often the way they react to situations under stress is to shoot and then ask questions.
So how does that? So
what I guess my point is, we have too many officers now who have psychological profiles that should raise red flags in terms of whether or not they should be police officers. And secondly, the training. You know, police officers are trained in sort of military style. They're trained on weapons, tactics, but they're not trained on what are the constitutional constraints of making arrests. So we want to talk about Tariq Hill. This is a classic example of police officers who have absolutely no idea what the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution is. And that is, you can't arrest somebody. And that when we say arrest, put them in handcuffs. I mean, police officers are allowed to detain people for a short amount of time under the Fourth Amendment. It's called a Terry stop, in which they can ask for your driver's license, identification, ask what you're doing, and the detention is supposed to be brief. And unless at that point the officer can develop what's called probable cause. What is probable cause? It's the backbone of the Fourth Amendment. The officer must have articulable facts that criminal activity has taken place. Not that they suspect it, that it has taken place. Then and only then may they make what's called a warrantless, because there's no warrant, arrest. Tariq Hill, there was zero probable cause to arrest him. He was arrested because he pissed off a cop. In fact, he didn't commit any crime. Traffic violations are not crimes. And so many police officers don't even understand this, let alone the public. A traffic violation is simply that. It is even less than a summary offense. A summary offense is a violation in which the only penalty is a fine. That's what a traffic violation is. Does not allow the officer to arrest you. What should have happened if Tariq Hill was speeding? The police officer should have asked for identification, driver's license, registration, insurance card, write the ticket, give the ticket, goodbye. That's it. But I can't tell you how many times on a yearly basis, just in this state of Pennsylvania, and the Pennsylvania State Police are notorious for this, traffic violations turn into incidents in which citizens are subjected to illegal arrest and worse, excessive force.
Question for you.
Sure.
We're going to get into, you know, the best ways to obviously impact that situation. And I saw the video of what happened to Tariq Hill, and it was definitely shocking. I mean,
terrible.
Having said that, you know, it's a tough job, okay? And I can't think of I'm just thinking about myself. So one of the things I would think would be one of the scariest things, two areas of probably something that happens every day. And that is pulling somebody over, okay, and having to walk up to that car not knowing what's going on there. That's got to be scary as hell. And a domestic dispute, knocking on somebody's door when emotions are through the roof, okay? I've had this guy, rest his soul, he passed away, but we've had this conversation on how do we maximize and minimize those incidents and all those things. And I do believe that it's a very deep question. And I say that because it probably starts with the recruiting of police officers and, you know, obviously education and all those things. But I also thought, and I'm not a schooled expert in the area, but for example, you know, first of all, nobody knows how they're going to react. No one, even if no matter what your profile is as a person before you get on the force, no one. It's just like probably the service. How would you possibly know how you're going to react when somebody pulls a gun on you or, you know, so it, I don't know how you get.
But those situations, you see, they rarely,
no, I know.
Rarely happen.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying it's a scary, I'll give you an example. I owned a nightclub for 15 years. It was one of the biggest ones in the city.
Which club?
It was called Emerald City.
Oh, sure. I remember. Right.
There he goes. I knew that.
We're the same age. We're both 60.
Right, right. But this is the Emerald City in Philly, not Jersey.
I know. It was on
between Spring Garden and Cal.
I know exactly where it was.
Okay.
I never attended.
So
I wasn't born yet.
How do you think we met? No, but we just closed it in 2000. I guess 15 is getting far, right?
I don't even know if I was legally drinking at that point yet, Joe.
But you know what's interesting about it, Joe? I'm not absolutely not defending people who, are brutalizing people and doing the wrong thing. But I used to talk to my, so when you're in a club business of that magnitude, okay, you are going to get some difficult situations.
Sure.
At the highest level imaginable. Mm-hmm. And I made a living at when one of the police officers retired, they took over for security at a big place.
So you hired you hired off duty Philadelphia police officers for security?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, but I used to work with the 6th District because of incident reports and
sure.
community and all those things.
Across the street on Vine Street. That's right.
Right down the street. But right.
Yeah.
So, well, at least it was when I was.
Yeah, it's like 10th and Vine. Yeah.
Right. And so I obviously would go there constantly. I was always going there to communicate if we had a big event. We would hire a police detail outside. Okay. but we had Act 235 guys outside also. And Act 235 is certified armed guards, never have that in inside. I wrote the rules for that retired police officer when he took over at Xfinity Live. He came to me because when you're a security guard and by the way, me and my brother, and he's my partner, had 11-hour arguments over security when we first got down there. Okay, because it was it's easier to find a brain surgeon walking on Market Street than a security guard that's not going to get you fired, sued, end your business, because your job is to kind of de-escalate, not
de-escalate and show restraint.
Exactly. But Joe, I used to speak that, and I've been in two fights in my entire life. Okay, I'm preaching that, and guess what? I'll never forget. It was a Sunday night. There was three people in the club, okay? And I'll never forget it. And my our security guards, there was about three of them. So there was as many security guards in a big room. And I'll never forget this. So I'm preaching all this crap. Now, we were not experts at club security at the time, but we were incredibly caring and didn't want to get sued and cared about our clients and all those things and understood that. So two of our security guards in a room that's 4,000 square feet, okay, were goofing off and tripped over the only couch in the middle of the damn room. You couldn't do it if I put a blindfold over you and fell on one of the girls and broke her nails. She went nuts.
Say nail, like her
nails.
Okay.
She went nuts. I went up, Mr. De-escalate and all that stuff. And she got in my face like there was no tomorrow. And I lost my cool.
Did she physically attack anybody?
No. She just went nuts. I tried to.
Screaming and yelling.
Screaming. And mostly at me. I thought I was the big club owner. She went right at me. And I within minutes, I was going right back at her.
When you say go at each other, you mean verbal. Yeah.
But let me just tell you what happened. I didn't only not de-escalate the situation after she went at me hard because I got defensive. She told me, she was from the Badlands, by the way. She said, I'll be right back. And I knew what she meant. She's like, you know, we're not. You
she
know.
Was going to get a whip.
Well, it wasn't her. She was going back.
She's going to get her people.
Yeah, her people. And I, she never did come back. And there was no incident as far as physical. What I'm saying is that was one of the great lessons of my life. And what I mean by that is you can practice in the game. You know what Mike Tyson said, everybody's got a plan until they get hit. Well, what I'm saying about, I've had this conversation with my best friend, and I'm a middle of the road type of guy. And I know you know this, okay? And it's not a part of negligence in the fact, because things are going to happen, okay? But when that crap hits the fan, okay, you never know. So how are you going to have somebody, you look at the police. Now, so the only thing I can think of, Joe, is the hiring process and to make sure people are not high risks coming in.
Well, if I could, from your example, I think there's a difference there.
There is a difference.
And this is how I'll try to characterize the difference. The situation that you just told us about related to your years in the club business is the difference between a reactive situation and a situation in which you're provoking a bad situation. In your situation, your security people react when something bad happens. But quite often, especially with vehicle stops, police officers provoke a situation. I'll give you a class example. I'm sure you're familiar with, back in the early 2000s, the New Jersey State Police were conducting profile vehicle stops, especially on the Jersey Turnpike, to such an extent that the Department of Justice, and this was under the Bush administration, brought a dissent decree against the New Jersey Police because after they had done exhaustive research of all the arrests, the overwhelming number of motorists that were stopped were African American, something like 80, 90% of them. And it was clear that these were pretextual stops. There was no criminal activity. There was not even reasonable suspicion of traffic violations. These officers were proactively patrolling, looking for a profile, because they said that, you know, we would look for license plates that were from out of state, especially Florida license plates, because they said, well, you know, that's generally speaking where we find motorists who may be concealing contraband and drugs, and we're just going to stop them. That is such a violation of the Fourth Amendment that it is just egregious. So I had a number of cases where the same thing has been happening throughout Pennsylvania with Pennsylvania state troopers. I've had a number of cases, and you can see from their dash cam. Oh, by the way, just let you know about Pennsylvania State Police. They are the last state police organization to finally get body cams, which has only happened, quite frankly, I think one of the reasons is the Anthony Allegrini murder, which was a murder by State Trooper Robert Stobeck. They didn't even have body cams. That being said, from these dash cam videos, you see the same pattern over and over. A police officer gets behind a black or Hispanic motorist and is trying so hard to find some reason to pull this person over. So how is that different than the nightclub situation? In a nightclub situation, you have security people who are just walking around, just making sure everything's okay. They are not going to inject their force, if they have to use it, unless something happens. If a fight breaks out, they react. That is not what is happening in a lot of policing in this country, especially on the roads. You have predator police who are driving around looking to harass citizens.
I got you. I'm not going to stereotype every police officer.
But getting back to your point about the dangers, yes, there are dangers with vehicle stops. But the problem is these officers increase their risk because they're trying to stop everybody, even when there isn't probable cause. And more likely than not, instead of getting into a dangerous situation, the officer creates a dangerous situation and then ends up violating the civil rights of somebody from an illegal stop, an illegal arrest. And then when they get pissed off because the person protests, "Why are you arresting me? I haven't done anything." That's when the excessive force occurs and someone gets hurt.
No, I understand. And by the way, I am not talking about situations like that, okay? In other words, I get it. When somebody's wrong, they're wrong, okay? What I'm saying is there have been a ton of situations, I'm sure, that are not exactly like that, where crowds and there's all kinds of things that have happened where somebody, they're not exactly by, and there's a million different scenarios. My point is, the conditions are not ideal for under any circumstance. Imagine there is, I've seen situations, well, you can go on YouTube and see situations, where, there's conflict and somebody may overreact or panic or something like that. I'm not talking about somebody who's starting trouble. Okay, because those aren't the only situations. It's a difficult job, and I can imagine that you're not the same person 6 years in, depending upon where you're stationed. So the question I have is, and I'm not defending somebody, no matter. Let's look at the George Floyd situation. Okay, there's a situation where I'll never forget that. My wife, her father was a police officer. Her uncle was a police officer. Her mom's, that was on her dad's side. Her dad's, her mother's brother got killed in the war with 3 days left in Vietnam. They had the street signs up, okay? But we were sitting there and watching this and couldn't believe what we were watching. I guess what I'm saying is—
You're talking about the George Floyd,
right. And we were sitting there, and I will tell you this, because I'm not disputing, individuals that have committed crimes and doing the things that you're talking about under any circumstance. If somebody is the aggressor and the cops out there profiling and doing those things, clearly that's a violation of civil rights. But you can't argue with the fact I can't imagine, and I've talked to, I'm sure, a decent amount of police and those that are high ranking that were just as upset about that as anybody else because they knew what that does. You have these situations that you're talking about that are egregious that cannot happen, but there's a lot of good police officers out there and they watched that and went, here we go. Like, in other words, now there's a target on everybody's head. Also, I just want...
When you say target...
I'm just talking about the media. In other words, everybody's going to stereotype that every police officer, in other words, and they create an adversarial situation. So the defund the police movement, for example...
Terrible.
Well, what I'm saying is, who does that hurt more than anybody? People in low income areas, doesn't matter, whether it's white or black, but nobody in those areas were sitting up and going, defund the police, because who are you going to call? Now, that doesn't alleviate the fact that, that does not alleviate the fact that you're going to have, so there's so many, issues about that. And by the way, civil rights and people's, people's rights being violated and changing, and there's individuals whose lives, listen to me, I'll tell you, I'll go so far as to say my father spent the rest of his life in jail and did not and was not involved in what happened, okay?
What happened?
He was a union leader, okay? And his guys, he was, for 40 years, he was a union leader, mm-hmm. okay? And he had great guys on the street, business agents and organizers, fantastic, for 40 years. But he got unlucky. And a group of guys got in there and they started going after non-union jobs by going out with little teeny hammers and hammering the anchor bolts. So when the non-union job guy went to put the column down, right, they couldn't do it because they couldn't put a little nut on the anchor bolt because the threads were all messed up. Okay, what they were really doing is saying, you're not allowed to build non-union here or this is what's going to happen. Okay, so you're not talking to somebody who's has a blind eye to anything because the feds who went after him, it was a nice. My dad never even had a parking day. He was 75 years old.
Yeah.
Okay. And because of mandatory minimums and the RICO squad, because some idiot went and burned a facade. My dad, because of the bylaws, and every man in that union flat out came out and said, "Mr. Doc never told us to do anything wrong." But he was the responsible party, okay? And he got caught up in a RICO. He wasn't even, when he got taken to the holding cell, 9 years, Google it. It was on the front page of Google. 9 years ago this happened. He gets to the cell, and the guys that are in there, they said, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "I don't know what I'm doing here." So I'm telling you that for one reason. I have no blind eye to law enforcement going over lines, but I am not going to sit here and stereotype every police officer in the country, okay, and every law enforcement because I'm not going to throw in the old because of a few bad eggs. I get it. It's a systemic situation. So if you're going to violate somebody's civil rights and some human being that's driving on a highway and gets profiled because somebody's got a hard on for them, okay, and can't, and maybe has PTSD, maybe not just because they were in the service, but maybe because they've been in the same district for 40 years or 10 years. My thought process, I'm on the side of prosecuting individuals who have done things the wrong way, okay? 100%. But I'm also on the side of law enforcement and police that have, gotten a bad name because a bunch of cowboys out there, are going over the line every day and out to hurt somebody.
Well, let me try to sort of unpack this a little bit. When you talk about the defund the police sort of adage that was, I'm a lifelong Democrat. I thought that was
so. Am I? I'm a lifelong Democrat too.
Yeah, it was terrible. And if you ask anybody that does the work I do, anybody from the National Police Accountability Project, anybody who does this kind of work, that's the last. Police need more funding, but what they don't need is funding for weapons, tactical units. I mean, if you look at the funding that has been coming into many police departments over the last sort of decade and a half since the end of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, there was this glut of military equipment that was being donated to police forces. And it's insane what some of these small town police forces were able to get. They were able to get these, military vehicles, automatic weapons, things that they don't need. What they do need is education. The average police officer only gets 6 months of training. Mm-hmm. If you go to Europe, England, France, Germany, most police officers get at least 2 years of education just on being a police officer. So I think that quite often police officers are not trained in the constitutional rights of citizens and what the borderlines are. They're not trained in de-escalation and restraint. I'll give you another example that I think illustrates the issue and shows you the problems with well-funded police departments and underfunded police departments. I had a friend who was living in Lower Marion Township. And for those of you who don't know Lower Marion Township,
It's one of the richest, most successful townships in America.
Yeah, definitely in Pennsylvania. And they have a police force. It's not a big police force. I don't even think they have more than 30 or 40 police officers. But because of the nature of the people that live in Lower Marion, very highly educated people, high income, there's definitely a understanding amongst the police force that they have to act with restraint. So my friend had a daughter who was in high school, who was under a lot of mental distress. And this is a classic example of where police officers encounter someone who is under mental distress. There have been so many cases where these type of situations end very badly. In Lower Merriam, when these officers came, what they found was a young girl who was exhibiting violent behavior. She didn't have a weapon, but violent behavior against her parents or siblings. She was in a state of complete mental breakdown. The Lower Merriam police officers handled the situation with incredible restraint. They made sure that they didn't raise their voices. They didn't act aggressively. And what they did was they came into the situation to de-escalate and calm the girl down. The parents were obviously in distress, and they were in the midst of a horrible situation. What did the officers do? They calmed the parents down. The same situation in a rural township in Pennsylvania escalates, in which the officers get angry at the young girl because she is not being compliant. They are dismissive of the parents, and they go in aggressively. They grab the girl. They throw her down. They handcuff her. They hit her numerous times. That's the issue. The issue is, how do we train our officers to react in situations? I have a long-term police expert that I use who is a former Pennsylvania State police officer, Pennsylvania State trooper, rose to the rank of supervising lieutenant, et cetera. And he said that the biggest issue in law enforcement is restraint. When is there a situation where an officer has to go beyond restraint? And he said, rarely, if ever. Most situations require de-escalation.
Well, it's interesting.
That's the difference. You look at situations in England. They often have situations with unruly people, with knives, etc. Rarely is anyone ever shot. What you have is, you have police officers in a situation who will surround a person. They will walk with them and slowly get them to drop their weapon and restrain.
Okay, but like you said before, okay, very interesting. So you brought up the trap. We talked about the traffic violations and you know, family situations, which. But then you have your crowd situations, your occupancy type situations. I ran into the same thing at the nightclub. I had a lot of cops that were phenomenal at coming into the middle of the chaos. Okay, most of them were, and I respected them for it. It was one time we had. It was a Sunday night. It was a woman police officer, and she had no tolerance. I mean, literally came in. She came in stressed out. Okay, now it didn't go anywhere. But I even said to her, because I said, chill down, because this, my whole thing is always de-escalation. That was my point of my conversation. But I got in the middle of that crap, and it was only one girl. And I thought, so we used to have all kinds of strategies. Okay, never one person walk up to somebody, because you can get hit from the side. You know, you talk about weapons and all those things. I'm going to tell you right now, I'm a moderate Dem. I believe in the right to bear arms, not to be able to outgun the police. And I think it should be common sense. And I'll tell you why. And I've had this conversation many times. Just like drugs. Drugs are illegal. But, you know, the bad guys typically find a way to get them. So if they're walking, if there's, and I'm just saying this to somebody who, If the public couldn't carry a gun, then you'd have a bad guy walking down the street. No one, you know, all these houses has the right to bear arms. But that's common sense is, and we're not going to get into that issue. I believe in the right to bear arms, but I believe in it in a common sense way. There's no reason why some young person should be able to get an AK-47 or whatever the hell you call them, an outgun law enforcement.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
This goes to what your point about your nightclub.
Yeah.
Did you allow anyone to bring a weapon in if they had a concealed carry permit?
Absolutely not, but it's a funny question because so you're talking to somebody who spent hours, nights.
So you believe in the right of a private owner of a property, whatever, to restrict who can and can't have weapons in your property?
Well, if a police officer could not leave a gun in a car, we would put it in a safe. But we did not allow.
I'm talking about your patrons.
Yeah, your patrons are not allowed to bring weapons in the club.
You know, in Texas, that's a serious issue.
I hear you, but
I mean, it's. Let me give you a little insight.
Just sort of law enforcement when you go there to get your when you go to get your zoning and all that. Even though it's common sense because somebody's carrying, obviously, they may have a permit and all that. The fact of the matter is, you can't even get in the nightclub business or in the hospitality business. That's not my rule, even though it's a common sense rule, because you throw alcohol and weapons in the same place, you got a problem.
Yeah.
So my point is, that's a common sense situation, but the other thing is, you can't do it if you want to. So in other words, allowing somebody just because they have a permit to carry to come in will get you lose your liquor license for doing it. There's rules and regulations. So it's a short discussion if somebody, but it's a common sense type situation.
Do you know in Texas, it's a serious issue because of the open carry laws?
I hear you.
I mean, you have people who have supermarkets, right? They can't stop somebody coming in with an open carry assault weapon.
I mean, I thought in Florida, can't you shoot somebody if they park in your parking spot or something nuts? I mean,
well, that's the stand your ground law, which is horrible.
Yeah, and so my point to you is, obviously, but that's not what I'm talking about in general. The right to bear arms. Here's an even crazier situation. You are a law-abiding citizen. You have a permit to carry a weapon, and you, let's just say your daughter or your son lives in New York, and they just called you. You live in PA, okay? There was a fire and a tragic fire, whatever. But they got out. But they're outside. You're zooming in New York. You forget you're carrying your gun. Okay, now you're going to jail on a mandatory minimum. So there's a lot of different laws and rules that are common sense. And I'll tell you this right now. I think, and this is maybe the issue with a ton of different things. The stuff that you're, the issues of the civil rights violations that you're talking about, they're egregious and there's no excuse for them. They make every other law enforcement officer and every other state trooper organization who is doing it right look bad. So, but that doesn't get them off the hook. That, in other words, here's another example of a nightclub. Okay, and we do talk about personal injury and a lot of different things. You do personal injury. Your firm does personal injury. A lot of times it comes down to money, and I'll tell you what I mean by that. Okay. There's no security guard at that back door. My partners, I'm sitting in a room. Maybe I'm one of the partners. I go, you know what? Nobody goes, it's not open to the public. So we're not going to spend the $150 to $200, okay? Until somebody gets in that door and assaults somebody. Now, all of a sudden, I'm sitting here my point is until they get bit in the butt, until some police organization or some other negligent owner of a department store who doesn't care if people are throwing milk on the ground and doesn't clean it up for 2 hours. Well, until they get bit in the butt, if they're doing things in a negligent fashion, okay, until, that law enforcement agency who's not doing it the right way and gets bit in the butt and it hits their pocket.
You're saying that'll
that's where they get the attention.
That's where the reform will come.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So in other words, I'm not saying it does all the time, Joe.
Let me throw a wrench into that.
In my business,
it does. You're saying the money changes. Well, let me give you an example of why that's not happening in law enforcement. Are you familiar with the city of Chester bankruptcy?
Yeah.
Okay. So I've had numerous cases against the city of Chester for police misconduct. There are only two cities in state of Pennsylvania that are self-insured, that have enough money because they're cities of the first class. That's Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. Everybody else, any municipality, township, they have to have their own insurance policies for liability. Chester has a multi-million dollar liability policy. They have been sued so many times. The city of Chester, one of the most notoriously horrible police departments in the state of Pennsylvania, that now their deductible is $150,000. Okay? So how does this create havoc? Well, the city now is in bankruptcy. So they can't pay the $150,000. So right now, the police department in the city of Chester now has carte blanche to commit acts of police misconduct up to $150,000 with zero repercussions. Does the money matter? It doesn't. Often, issues, and you've read about this, the city of Philadelphia now, you know, over $60 million in police misconduct settlements and verdicts. Who pays for it? The taxpayers. It's the taxpayers that have to stand up and say, enough. Enough of this. There needs to be reform. But you have a police union in Philadelphia that will do anything it can to obstruct reform and obstruct getting the bad officers off the street. And it's not just 5 or 10%. It's 25, 30% of police officers that create the havoc, and that's too many.
So having said that, okay, you know, it's that, you know, might as well, we got 4 minutes left. I mean, the question is, how do we improve these situations? And I think a lot of it has to do with...
Well, the first thing you need to do is have citizen review committees that are made up of citizens, made up of elected officials who have the power, the subpoena power, as well as the judicial power to have officers fired.
Okay.
And then the second thing is you have to change the union contracts. Many of these union contracts are so weighed in favor of the police, especially when it comes to arbitration issues, in which they
get... Because they are all arbitration.
Yeah, because they get to decide solely who the arbiter is, and it's only one arbiter. And, you know, I can't tell you how many times in the city of Philadelphia, officers who've been caught red-handed in corruption, excessive force, even murder... and survived arbitrations.
So how do we stop it from starting? Not being be proactive, not reactive.
Screening police officers from the start. I mean, if police officers have had any issues with post-traumatic stress disorder, I think that military combat veterans should never be police officers. I'm sorry. I mean, being in a situation where you have learned to shoot first and then ask questions is not the profile to be a police officer. You have to show restraint and then training. There has to be so much more training of police officers, which doesn't happen in this country.
Are there any areas, you mentioned Lower Merion, right, obviously, there's something going on there.
They're getting it right because they train, not only they train their officers with so much more regarding constitutional rights of people, and they train them in de-escalation and restraint. That has to be within police training.
Okay, and when you talk about the standards, okay, literally speaking, there is, I believe, there's a police test, right? Okay, and so they tried to open that up, okay, I think in certain areas, okay, and it, in a sense, discriminated against, you know, a lot of the people that, you know, that they wanted to get in. And so, you know, how do you, you know, I agree. It starts at the beginning. Okay. All right. And, you know, this conversation, when you know, is an important one. It has to be continued. Joe, contact information if anybody wants your...
I can be contacted at my law office. It's Oxman, O-X-M-A-N, the letter J, Oxman J, at OGKLawyers.com.
Caitlin, if you would, contact information.
Yeah, and Joe, by the way, just thank you so much. I was quiet this whole time, just enjoying listening to you talk. Contact information, files, injurylawyers.com, all the social media, files, law office, and phone numbers 215-987-6452.
Awesome. Well, listen, it's been a spirited conversation. It is a passionate conversation, not one I'm afraid to have under any circumstances. There's two sides to it, but the side you're representing are individuals that are you know, having their civil rights, and there's no excuse for it. I don't have, listen, literally speaking, you know, this is something, and we should do this again and cover.
Absolutely.
I mean, and because it's something that is vitally important. I want to thank everybody for tuning into the Files Law Hour here on WWDB. I want to thank Joe Oxman for being our guest on the show. Of course, Caitlin Files. Shout out to Tyler in the booth. On behalf of everybody on the panel, I'm Joe Dougherty. Thanks for listening.